Hey, this is Mark Stein. Welcome along to our last movie date of 2020, in which we look back at some of those we lost in the last 12 months, from the most glittering stars to boom operators and dialect coaches. The Chinese coronavirus clobbered a lot of them, but not all. Anne Reinking died suddenly from non-COVID causes just before Christmas. Here she is as Daddy Warbuck's secretary in the film version of Annie, with the perfect opening number for any year other than this.
Come on, Annie. Let's go to the movies.
Let's go see the stars.
Cowboy heroes, cops and robbers, glamour and strife. Bigger than life. Sitting in the darkness, what a world to see. Let's go to the movies, Annie. Wait and see. Betty Davis is probably lying and Greta Garbo is probably crying while Robert Taylor is locked in her dying embrace. Chico and Groucho and Chaplin and Lloyd are all super. Sweet Mickey Mouse, Shirley Temple and dear Jackie
Let's
Cooper.
Let's go to the movies.
Let's go see the stars. Fred and Ginger.
Let's go to the movies. Well, you can't. Back in the spring, when this Chi-Com 19 blight took off, I was thinking, this thing's kind of like Jaws. Some of us are like the mayor and thinking, shut down the beach, are you crazy? And others are like the Richard Dreyfuss character and saying, these teeth marks are way bigger than a regular shark, everyone's going to die. And the rest of us are trying to do a Chief Brody and steer a middle course. But in the end, a lot of it's to do with your allotted role in the narrative. For instance, if you happen to be the mother of a young boy eaten by the shark.
Chief Brody?
Yes?
I just found out that a girl got killed here last week. And you knew it. You knew there was a shark out there. You knew it was dangerous. But you let people go swimming anyway. You knew all those things. But still, my boy is dead now. And there's nothing you can do about it. My boy is dead. I wanted you to know that.
Lee Fierro as the grieving Mrs. Kintner in Jaws, in the famous face-slapping scene with Roy Scheider. Steven Spielberg did not want a star-studded cast for Jaws, despite pressure from the studio, because he thought, for example, that Charlton Heston, who wanted to play the police chief, would give it a glamour and grandeur that would undermine the sense of a normal small town under attack. He filmed it in Martha's Vineyard, and many in the cast were locals, like Lee Fierro, who was the artistic director of the Island Theatre Workshop. And after she'd hit the big screen in Jaws, she went right back to being artistic director of the Island Theatre Workshop, where she stayed for another 42 years, beloved by hundreds and hundreds of actors who passed through that small Martha's Vineyard Island Theatre. Dead of the coronavirus at the age of 91, Lee Fierro, as with her kid in the movie, They waited too long to close the beach.
Slaves you were, and slaves you remain. But the terrible penalty of crucifixion has been set aside on the single condition that you identify the body or the living person of the slave called Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus!
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 I'm Spartacus! I'm
Spartacus! Everyone says he's Spartacus, but Kirk Douglas was Spartacus, just as he was Vincent van Gogh and Bick Spiderbeck and Doc Holliday, and he kept going. At the age of 101, he appeared at the Golden Globes with his daughter-in-law, Catherine Zeta-Jones. He died just before this year's Oscars, aged 103. Oh, and that's something else he could do better than the charmless sluggards who can't even read a list of five nominees off a prompter. Here are Kirk Douglas and his pal Burt Lancaster at the 1958 Academy Awards.
What's next, Burt? Best actor. Who's been nominated? Well, Tony Franciosa, Tony Quinn. Marlon Brando. Charles Laughton. Alec Guinness. Well, who else? Well, that's it. Well, I guess, Bert, you haven't been nominated this year. No, you haven't been either, Kirk. Congratulations.
It's great not to be nominated, great not to be nominated, great merely to sit here and relax. Since we have been bested, we're not interested, but who stuck those knives in our backs? When a producer suggests a role to us, he says the Oscar could be the goal to us. Comes March and they won't even give a measly scroll to us. It's great not to be vying for it, great not to be sighing for it. March, isn't that just the month for tax? Externally, each nominee's a casual sight. To look at them, you'd never think they're tense and tight. Well, the best acting they've done this year, they've done tonight. We're sitting here in the clear. Not to be nominated,
great
not to be nominated, but just wait until next year.
If you're a Star Wars nerd, and I gather they're almost as numerous as Mark Steyn's show nerds, you'll be familiar with this scene from the original film of Luke Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi arriving in their land speeder at the spaceport of Mos Eisley.
Move along.
I can't abide those Jawas. Disgusting creatures. Go on. I can't understand how we got by those troops. I thought we were dead.
The Force can have a strong influence on the weak-minded.
Although Mos Eisley is a wretched hive of scum and villainy, as Alec Guinness puts it, the arrival of the land speeder isn't exactly a crucial or memorable scene. But it became so 4 decades after the release of the picture, when a newly revealed behind-the-scenes photograph of the moment caught the fancy of Star Wars World. Not for Luke, not for Obi-Wan, not for C-3PO, but for the bloke holding the boom mic.
Above Luke Skywalker's landspeeder is the boom mic to record the sounds of the heroes on screen. It's who holds this boom mic that has sparked cosplayers and memes throughout the years. Follow the lone boom mic pole, and you will see the boom mic operator standing there in the hot sun, doing his job, dressed only in very short and very tight pink shorts. Now that you've seen him, it's very hard to see this scene and not think of the man in pink shorts holding the boom mic above their head.
Well, it was Tunisia, in the desert, and very hot. But standing next to the guy in tighty-tighty-tight pink briefs was George Lucas, and in the picture, he's got his clothes on.
The pink shorts and that body belong to Ken Nightingale. He is now 90 years old and living outside London.
Ken began his career in British film with the 1963 thriller Paranoiac and worked on the sound teams for Alfie, The Boys from Brazil, Supergirl, and a lot of Bond films, Octopussy, For Your Eyes Only, View to a Kill. But his pink shorts in that crew shot made Ken Nightingale a Star Wars star. The fans dubbed him Pink Shorts Boom Guy, and he became a staple character of the cosplay routines at comic conventions. God knows Star Wars is as thoroughly exhausted a seam as one could imagine, so the buffs seized gratefully on Ken's pink booty shorts. And for the last 5 years of his life, reenactors of key scenes would be accompanied by a fellow in pink shorts, socks and shoes stalking the actors with a long boom pole over their heads. And a retired sound man suddenly found he was the model for Star Wars action figures and Lego minifigures, although the more punctilious types noticed that not all the merchandise nor all the reenactors took the trouble to have their pink shorts made out of the authentic British terry toweling. Pink Shorts Boom Guy enjoyed his late life fame, but I would like to think it did not alter his and his mate's verdict of Star Wars as they shot it that broiling hot summer over 40 years ago. We thought it was the biggest load of crap we'd ever worked on. Dead of the Chinese coronavirus at the age of 92, Ken Nightingale. Also dead at the age of 89, Lucia Bozzè, the winner of Miss Italia 1947.
La riconoscete? È la signorina Lucia Bozzè, Miss Italia 1947. Porta i suoi 16 anni sotto i fuochi fotoelettrici del teatro Incom, per la cresima della gloria, il provino.
1947 was a good year. Lucia Bozzè was up against Gina Lollobrigida. And young Lucia beat Signorina Lollobrigida and took the Miss Italia title. She became a leading lady of Italian neorealist cinema in the 1950s. Here she is, not yet 20, in Antonioni's first feature film, Cronaca di un Amore.
Anche tu sei cambiato, ti sei messo a fare complimenti. Da quando ci conosciamo è la prima volta.
Is there anybody who watches La Dolce Vita for the shoes? I mean, Anita Ekberg, sure. Marcello Mastroianni. Anouk Aimée, Nino Rota's music. But who pays attention to the shoes?
Buonasera Maddalena, come sta? Sola? Vuole ballare?
No.
Beviamo una vodka?
No, mi va tutto storto stasera. Vado via.
L'accompagno.
Well, Federico Fellini did, and he loved the footwear of a young man called Sergio Rossi, the son of a shoemaker from San Mauro Pascoli. Sergio was 25 and Fellini decided that Anita Ekberg would wear his shoes in La Dolce Vita. And people did notice, and Sergio Rossi became a world-famous shoe designer and a global luxury brand. When the coronavirus hit Northern Italy, Signor Rossi gave 100,000 euros to the Luigi Sacco Hospital in Milan. Not all his wealth could save him. He died about 10 miles from where he was born, in the part of Italy he loved best, but also, alas, the most afflicted by the Wuhan scourge. Dead of the China coronavirus at the age of 84, Sergio Rossi. Buck Henry was a guy who did improv comedy who'd never written a screenplay. But Mike Nichols asked him to write The Graduate, and he turned in a memorable script.
Ben. Excuse me. Mr. McGuire. Ben. Mr. McGuire.
Come with me for a minute. I want to talk to you. Excuse us, Joanne.
Of course. Thank you.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
Exactly. How do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, I will.
Enough said. That's a deal.
What's better than going into plastics? Getting hired to co-write The Graduate and being given 16 2/3% of the profits. Oh, and Buck Henry also played the hotel clerk checking in Dustin Hoffman for his assignations with Anne Bancroft.
Excuse me. Yes, sir?
A room. I'd like a room, please.
Single room or a double room?
Single, just for myself, please.
Did you sign the register, please? Anything wrong, sir?
What? No, nothing.
Do you have any luggage, Mr. Gladstone?
Luggage? Yes, yes, I do.
Where is it?
What?
And where is your luggage?
Well, it's in the car. It's out there in the car.
Very good, sir. I'll have a porter bring it in.
Oh, no. I'd rather not go to all the trouble of bringing it all in. I just have a toothbrush. I can get it myself. That's all right.
Of course. I'll have a porter show you the room.
Oh, well, actually, I just as soon find it myself. I just have a toothbrush to carry up, and I can handle it myself.
Whatever you say, sir.
Thank you.
What can't COVID-19 do?
Hey, 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 happy campers! Look who's up to his old tricks.
That's right. Yogi Bear.
It's open season for fun in Jellystone Park.
Yeah. What can't COVID-19 do? It's managed to kill off Yogi Bear's girlfriend, Cindy Bear, or at least the actress who voiced Cindy for 3 decades.
Hello, Yogi.
How about that? Talking picnic basket.
I said, hello, Yogi.
Cindy, what's on your mind? As if it isn't oblivious.
Oh, it's spring again.
So I've been hearing.
It's when boy meets girl, something clicks, and they start sharing everything.
Sharing everything? I didn't hear any click.
It's a time when you whisper sweet nothings in my ear.
That I can do.
Ooh, Yogi.
Nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Nothing. And because you're such a sweet kid, here's another nothing for nothing.
Oh, Yogi.
Julie Bennett started out as a stage and screen actress in the Burns and Allen show, Superman and Dragnet. But she found her greatest success as the voice of enduring animated characters. In the 90s, she traded Yogi Bear for the Amazing Spider-Man as Peter Parker's paw put upon Aunt May.
Peter!
Aunt May!
What's going on?
Stay back!
Oh, yes. Dead of the Chinese coronavirus at the age of 88, Julie Bennett. The name was Connery. Sean Connery.
I admire your courage, Miss...
Trench. Sylvia Trench. I admire your luck, Mr...
Bond. James Bond.
Mr. Bond, I suppose you wouldn't care to, raise the limit?
I have no objections.
Now.
Looks like you're out to get me.
It's an idea at that.
The James Bond. Dreary critics would complain about the formula, but the formula was what the audience loved. And Goldfinger was when it all fell into place.
Now, what do you know about gold, money, Penny?
Oh, the only gold I know about is the kind you wear. You know, on the third finger of your left hand.
Hmm. Well, one of these days, we really must look into that.
Well, what about tonight? You come around for dinner, and I'll cook you a beautiful angel cake.
Well, nothing would give me greater pleasure, but unfortunately, I do have a business appointment.
That's the flimsiest excuse you've ever given me. Ah, well, some girls have all the luck. Who is she, James?
She is me, Miss Moneypenny.
And kindly omit the customary byplay with 007. He's dining with me, and
I don't want him to be late.
So there's hope for me yet.
Byplay with the boss's secretary and with the madman bent on world domination.
Choose your next witticism carefully, Mr. Bond. It may be your last. The purpose of our two previous encounters is now very clear to me. I do not intend to be distracted by another. Good night, Mr. Bond.
Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Dr. No was the first Bond film, and From Russia with Love, the second, but it was the third in the series, Goldfinger, that definitively put in place the formula that, to one degree or another, has held for almost six decades. The pre-title sequence leading into the song with the dolly birds twirling around gun barrels and all the rest of it. I feel a pang of wistful regret at the way so many people who made that film so special are taking their leave. Honor Blackman.
Who are you?
My name is Pussy Galore.
I must be dreaming.
Ah, we all were. Honor Blackman, who played Pussy Galore unforgettably. We also lost Margaret Nolan, who was the gilded girl in the titles, not the dead, gold-sprayed body in the hotel room scene later on, that was Shirley Eaton, but in the title sequence. Miss Nolan had small but memorable parts, not just in Goldfinger, but in another landmark film from the 60s, Help with the Beatles. She was in Ferry Cross the Mersey with Jerry and the Pacemakers and a handful of Carry On movies, including Carry On Matron and Carry On Dick. She was in The Saint and Danger Man, The Morecambe and Wise Show and Brideshead Revisited, and then decided she wanted to be a visual artist. She was secure enough to enjoy her moment and enjoy that it endured across the decades. After the title sequence of Goldfinger, the camera swoops over the Miami Beach skyline, and we glimpse the Fontainebleau Hotel, the famous Fontainebleau Hotel, all to some especially fine John Barry music. And then we come down to Earth, where Margaret Nolan as Dink is giving Sean Connery as 007 a massage. In fact, neither Connery nor Miss Nolan are anywhere near Miami Beach. They're on a soundstage at Pinewood Studios in England, pretending to be a massage session in Florida. Alas for 007, the much-needed downtime is interrupted by the CIA's Felix Leiter, who needs Bond and fast.
How's this?
That's nice. Very nice.
Just here?
No, a little lower, darling.
I thought I'd find you in good hands.
Felix! Felix, how are you? Dink, meet Felix Leiter.
Hello.
Felix, say hello to Dink.
Hi, Dink.
Dink, say goodbye to Felix.
Hmm?
Man talk.
That crisp, clean slap is Sean Connery playfully swatting Margaret Nolan's delightful posterior. Don't try that at home, boys and girls. That dialogue is by Richard Maybaum and or Paul Dean, in case you're so triggered you need to file hate crime charges. Dink herself was happy to recreate the moment at fan conventions through the years. Dead at the age of 76, Margaret Nolan. How do you top Sean Connery swatting Miss Nolan's bottom? Well, how about John Steed of the Avengers, Patrick McNee, singing about sexy little schoolgirls and the kinkiness of leather with the aforementioned Honor Blackman in leather and kinky boots? It made the UK pop charts in the 1990s. Here it is, somewhat to the bewilderment of the BBC Top of the Pops presenter.
Well, about this time of year, towards Christmas, some records, how shall I say, deviate from the norm. From the cult 60s TV show The Avengers, Kinky Boots.
Everybody's going for those kinky boots, kinky boots.
Kinky boots, it's a manly kind of fashion that you borrowed from the brutes.
Borrowed from the brutes. Kinky boots, fashion magazines, they wear 'em.
And you rush to obey like the women in a harem.
Full length, half length.
Fully fashioned cuffling.
Brown boots, black boots.
Patent leather jack boots.
Low boots, high boots.
Lovely lanky thigh boots.
We all dig those boots. Everybody's crazy for those kinky boots, kinky boots, kinky boots.
And whether you're in evening dress or bathing suit,
you wear boots, boots, a kinky boots.
Kinky Boots by an old friend of mine who left us this year, Herbie Kretzmer, lyricist of the stage and screen blockbuster Les Miserables. Let's add to that golden trio from Goldfinger, Sean Connery, Honor Blackman, Margaret Nolan, one more Bond girl, the most tragic of all. For one generation, Diana Rigg will always be Mrs. Peel in The Avengers. For another, she will always be Olenna, the Queen of Thorns in Game of Thrones. In between, she was the only woman who ever got to call herself, if not for long, Mrs. James Bond in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. She was a compelling and domineering presence in the very creepy BBC series Mother Love, a rather humane Mrs. Danvers in Rebecca, and just a magnificent Medea in the West End and on Broadway. One of the best nights in the theatre I've ever had. She was diagnosed with cancer just as Britain went into lockdown in March, and like Britain, she never came out. Back in the 90s, I went to the theatre in my critic's capacity and having been let down by my date. And just before curtain up, down the aisle came Dame Diana, also flying solo, and slid into the seat next to me. And as there was a rather long line for the ice cream tubs at the interval, we fell into conversation. I wouldn't want to work out how old she was back then, but she was very effortlessly sexy. She began wearing her hair in bangs, that distinctive low-lying fringe of hers, around about the age women are told they should quit wearing bangs because it's too girly. But she carried it off. I think it was the combination with the smile and the cheekbones, and she stuck with that style. Neither of us introduced each other, it being just neighbourly chit-chat till Act Two began, but obviously I knew who she was, and she let it be known that she knew who I was because friends of hers sent her vicious clippings of my work every so often. Round about 1980, She'd put together an anthology of the all-time worst theatre reviews and called it No Turn Unstoned. She just asked her actor chums for their worst reviews and said all the British guys eagerly responded and were pleased to do so. And the Americans were a bit more standoffish and sensitive about the whole thing. Everybody and his auntie have tried doing this sort of thing, but Diana Riggs is the very best of these stinker review anthologies. I refer to it often and read it for pleasure quite a lot if I'm sick in bed or whatnot. And Diana was always under pressure to do an updated and expanded edition, and in fact in recent years took to doing it as a one-woman show. But the reason she did it is because when she made her Broadway debut in Abelard and Heloise, there was a nude scene, and my old friend, the New York critic John Simon, did not care for it, or more specifically, for Dame Diana's contribution to it. "She is built," he wrote, "like a brick mausoleum with insufficient flying buttresses." Having seen her in a cocktail dress, I would dissent from that judgment. But she was at first hurt by it and then resentful and then came to appreciate it as a rather good line. She was, in a sense, flattered by him taking the trouble to be so vicious. And from that throwaway line of John Simon's, a book and a show emerged. She was a great artist, but never pretentious, very self-aware, and always grateful to television for, as she put it, making her. The Avengers of which I speak is not the hideous, bloated, witless superhero franchise, but a low-budget, high-style 60s series in which Patrick McNee as John Steed and Diana Rigg as Emma Peel had such killer chemistry. You didn't care the show had no money to pay for extras in the supposed London streets they were adventuring in. Here's their very first telly encounter.
Good morning, Mrs. Peel.
Good morning, Steed. The door's open.
Social visit?
That's it. Happened to be passing by. Thought I'd drop in.
The format was simple. Steed was retro, Mrs. Peel was modern. So he drove a vintage Bentley in racing green. She had a sporty Lotus Elan. Mrs. Peel fought with guns and karate moves. Steed had a sword stick and a steel-rimmed bowler. She was a married woman whose husband had vanished while on an expedition up the Amazon or some such. So their relationship was sexually unspecified, which is often the best way in drama. And in fact, because of Dame Diana's chemistry with Patrick McNee, they were sexier together than most of the sheet-crumpling screen couples of the time. That was one of many aspects the buffoons managed to ruin completely in the hideous big-screen remake of The Avengers, with a charmless Ralph Fiennes and a vulgar Uma Thurman as Steed and Mrs. Peel. Hollywood should have been put out of business permanently just for that excrescence. Having played Diana Rigg's first appearance as Mrs. Peel, I'll play her last, when the missing explorer husband suddenly turns up. And as they part, Steed calls her by her Christian name for the first and last time.
You see in the newspapers?
Yes.
Just him to make a dramatic reappearance. Found in a jungle.
The Amazonian jungle.
It's corny.
Ridiculous.
They've flown him back. He'll be picking me up in a few minutes.
Here?
Always keep your bowler on in times of stress. And watch out for diabolical masterminds.
I'll remember.
Goodbye, Steve.
Emma.
Excuse me, apartment 3.
At the top of the stairs, thanks. He likes his tea stirred anti-clockwise.
That's Mrs. Peel bumping into her successor on the stairs of Steed's flat, Tara King, played by my compatriot Linda Thorson. Dead at the age of 82, a great actress, whether in Agatha Christie or Shakespeare or Euripides, Dame Diana Rigg. I'm a bit of a purist when it comes to the term dialect coach, which has been applied somewhat more loosely in recent years. But at its essence, it means the guy who helps an actor develop the right voice for a stage or screen role that might require particular geographic or historic or social nuances. Andrew Jack was one of the very best in a highly specialised business. He worked with Pierce Brosnan, an Irishman, on his accent for James Bond, an Etonian Scotsman. You can see Andrew Jack on screen in 3 of the Star Wars films, if I'm counting correctly, but you can sort of tell it's the dialogue he's focused on. For the Lord of the Rings films, he invented an entire range of Middle Earth accents. Here's Andrew Jack rather more modestly with a brisk vocal tour of the British Isles.
Perceived pronunciation is the great communicator. As soon as you deviate from that and you go into London speech, for example, then you lose a little bit of the communication. Cockney is based on East Anglian, Suffolk, Norfolk, Cambridgeshire. This is often by actors confused with the West Country, where the R's come in and then you get Dorset and Somerset, get into Cornwall. Devon's slightly different. It goes into the nose a bit more like that. Then you go up north to Yorkshire. It's nice if you get a word that's got one of the predominant sounds in it, like Yorkshire, then you cross the Pennines into Lancashire, where it gets much more flexible and fluid in the mouth. Liverpool is there too, you know, it's Scouse. It's a mixture of all kinds of sounds. One of those is Northern Irish with the raising inflections, but you don't get the raising inflections down in Dublin, where it has that poetic quality, which is sometimes thought of as being not different from Highland speech, which is also quite poetic and almost Scandinavian. And then you come down to Glasgow and into the lowlands of Scotland, where you get glottal stops and things like that. And then you come down the west coast and you're in Wales, North Wales, where it's breathy like that, and down into South Wales, where you get much heavier, and Welsh people who sometimes even sound a bit drunk.
Dead of the Chinese coronavirus at the age of 76, 2 days after being diagnosed, Andrew Jack. We have been told that many COVID-19 deaths have taken place in care homes, retirement homes, assisted living facilities. Spain looks like a horror story in that respect, and such deaths apparently count for a quarter of all New York City fatalities. This is a snapshot of a few days at one such home.
And now, friends, we've come to the end of another season here in the Gulfstream Guild Theatre. A happy one for all of us, I assure you. And on this occasion, we're honored by a visit from one of the best-loved people in all America. She's here beside me now, Hollywood's favorite lady, Mary Pickford.
Thank you, Roger, and thank you, my friend. I'm here tonight on a very important mission. I come not as Mary Pickford, but as a representative of the entire motion picture industry. Tonight, you know, marks the end of our third season of Gulfstream Guild Theatre broadcast. During the past 3 years, Gulf has contributed generously to the Motion Picture Relief Fund, making possible the building of a home to provide for the aged and needy of our industry.
America's sweetheart and Canada's own, Mary Pickford, together with her husband, Douglas Fairbanks, Charlie Chaplin, Cecil B. DeMille, D.W. Griffith, and others, Miss Pickford founded the Motion Picture Relief Fund in 1921. And that home for the aged and needy in her industry still operates under what's now known as the Motion Picture and Television Fund. On April the 6th, Mary Pickford House, the fund's long-term care facility, reported its first death from the Chinese coronavirus. John Breyer, age 64, and a longtime member of Local 174 of the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees. The following day brought news of Alan Garfield, a character actor rarely out of work. He played Police Chief Lutz to Eddie Murphy's Beverly Hills Cop. Here he attempts to fire Murphy and his fellow Mavericks. It doesn't go well for him.
Looks like a goddamn war zone. What in hell have you done here, Tagger? Tell me.
We solved the alphabet crimes.
You shut up! Who the hell is talking to you? I personally solved the alphabet case up in a body bag over an hour ago. And you? I don't give a goddamn what federal agency you say you're working for. You're in jail, buddy.
Chief, wait a...
Shut up! What the hell do you think you're doing here, bringing down a firefight in the middle of my city? You're out of the cop business for good, forever.
Will you just listen a minute?
Shut up! You shut your mouth once and for all.
No, goddammit, you shut up! This is what the alphabet crimes are all about. Guns!
Guns?
That guy sold them, and then bought them with stolen money from Adriano's and his own racetrack. He was on his way to Central America. And if you'd bother to take your head out of your ass, you'd see we'd stop the whole goddamn thing!
You watch yourself!
Just a minute, Lutz. Why didn't I know about this?
Because Chief Lutz doesn't have the guts to hear the truth from real cops. That's why we had to go undercover with Detective Foley to solve this case.
That cuts it, Taggart. You're fired!
Yeah?
You're fired, too!
Lutz.
Isn't that right?
I think I've just about had it with your abusive attitude.
I'm sorry, I get carried away. I'm sorry.
You are fired. Do you understand that?
Don't overreact, Ted, please.
You're fired. I want you out of here now. Get out of here! Fired!
You'll regret this, Ted.
Alan Garfield co-starred in The Candidate, in Nashville, and Dick Tracy, and a lot of other films you might not have heard of, but which were important to him. He struck an artful balance.
Don't you hate the word when you say it's a business? I hate that word. It's not a business. It's artistic things. It's not a business.
Well, you know something?
Alan, I don't
I used to think... I used to be insulted when anybody also called it a business.
I hate it.
But do you know something, Skip? I think it's also incumbent. It's also incumbent on the actor, if he is to be out there in this real harsh, artistic,
beautiful world,
to also not be oblivious of the business side, but to be so isolated in just the artistic bent.
Yes.
And removed from the business side, you can have an actor with a multitude of talent wind up, by his own inadvertency, be overlooked professionally if he is not tuned in to some aspects of the business world.
I see. Yes.
Dead of the Chinese coronavirus on April the 7th at the age of 80, Alan Garfield.
The second star to the right shines in the night for you. To tell you that the dreams you planned really can come true. The second star to the right shines with a light so red. And if it's Neverland you need, its light will lead you there.
Anne Sullivan arrived at Walt Disney in the 50s and worked in the animation paint lab on, among many others, Peter Pan. She quit the industry to raise a family, then worked for Hanna-Barbera and returned to the Mighty Mouse to bring her skills to the Disney Renaissance on films like The Little Mermaid, Pocahontas, and The Lion King.
Some of us fall by the wayside, and some of us soar to the stars, and some of us sail through our trouble, some have to live with the scars.
Dead of the Chinese coronavirus on April the 13th, 3 days after her 91st birthday, Anne Sullivan. The cinematographer Alan Davio went a long way back with Steven Spielberg, back to 1968, and Spielberg's short film, but a very attention-getting film, Amblin. Among his many Oscar nominations were a trio of Spielberg films, The Color Purple, Empire of the Sun, and E.T. The last, Davio recalled, was a particular challenge.
He was very concerned about E.T. because here he was doing a movie which basically starred a rubber doll. And how was it not to be perceived as a rubber doll? And he knew we had to keep it in Dear E.T. in the dark for a great deal the beginning of the film. And it was only as we all got to know him that we began to see him more and more. And it was the kind of thing of... I would go over to Carlo Rambaldi's place, and Carlo was building E.T., and, you know, I would borrow a friend's Aeroflex. he later says, you should buy me a new Aeroflex. I would borrow his and shoot footage of E.T., and it was always at the beginning, no matter how low-key I thought it was, he was, no, it's too bright. So we developed a technique of keeping E.T. in the dark. Basically, he was always backlit. He would have a glow in his eye. He would have just the tiniest little bit of bounce light on him, and that's the E.T. that you met at the beginning of the film. And it was quite something. People to this day say to me, well, God, you could do it so much better now because you'd do it CGI. And I go, let me ask you something. If it was CGI, what would Drew Barrymore have had to look at age six? Hey, Drew, just look at this spot on the green backing. No, she had a real creature there. All the kids had a real creature to look at and communicate with.
Alan Davio's favorite scene in E.T. was the one in which Elliot, played by young Henry Thomas, says, I'm keeping him. The aforementioned Miss Drew Barrymore walks forward. There are highlights in E.T.'s eyes, no detail in the face, and the light is yellow. The effect, said Davio, very much that of a Maxfield Parrish painting. Dead of the Chinese coronavirus on April the 15th at the age of 77, the cinematographer Alan Davio phoned home. This right here is a career in television. 77 Sunset Strip. 77 Sunset Strip. 77 Sunset Strip. 77 Sunset Strip and The Virginian and Ironside and Magnum P.I. and
Knight Rider, a shadowy flight into the dangerous world of a man who does not exist.
Knight Rider. Joel Rogosin produced all of those and many more.
Of the innocent, the helpless, the powerless, in a world of criminals who operate above the law.
Dead of the Chinese coronavirus on April 19th, at the age of 87, Joel Rogosin. 5 deaths out of 162 residents at the Motion Picture and Television Fund's retirement home within just 2 weeks. One building, one virus that reaches out down the corridor to touch Beverly Hills Cop, The Lion King, E.T., Magnum P.I., three generations of American pop culture. Death will be an awfully big adventure, says Peter Pan, but not really, not so much when COVID-19 breathes on Mary Pickford House. Marge Champion was dancing ballet at the Hollywood Bowl by the age of 11, and at 18 she was hired by Walt Disney to model Snow White's physical movements. The animators couldn't quite bring her to life, not without Marge's help. She did the same for the dwarves, including putting on a bulky overcoat to double for Dopey, climbing atop Sneezy's shoulders to dance with Snow White. At 20, she was in the last Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers movie at RKO, and then she met Gower Champion and they married, and Marge and Gower Champion became eventually America's most famous dance couple. Here they are in Give a Girl a Break, 1953. I won't bother explaining the plot. They're on a rooftop and Gower Champion's character is explaining to her the realities.
What was it then? What made you change your mind?
It was a silly impulse and I thought better of it. Began to think, those rehearsals, all day, all night, the work, the hours, for what? Perfectly happy as I am.
Don't try to kid me. Why have you kept on practicing? Why have you kept at it day after day? So you could go to a fancy dress ball? I know you, this kind of thing isn't your dish. You belong in the theater. You need the theater as much as it needs you.
Oh, what's the use, Ted? You know I haven't got a chance.
Oh, now we're getting down to it, huh? You're scared. Don't you know you can dance circles around those kids? You just have to keep dancing and dancing and dancing. Got the jitters, that's all. The best dancer I ever knew. Come on, give me your hand. One, two, three, four. Left, right, left. That's it. Now, come on, let's go. Let it go. One. Two, double it. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, go. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. One, two, three, four.
And then they dance.
What's the matter? You tired already?
As a dancer, said Marge Champion, by the time you're 40, you're done. Not like acting or singing. Her husband, Gower, became one of the first generation of Broadway's powerhouse hyphenates. The choreographer-director, never regarded as a great visionary on the level of Jerome Robbins or Michael Bennett or Bob Fosse. He was the guy who delivered hits and A Great Night Out, Bye Bye Birdie, Hello Dolly, 42nd Street. He and Marge divorced, and she found work harder to come by. A one-off acting gig on The Kids from Fame, a program of reinvented worship services for Bel Air Presbyterian Church, the choreography job on the TV musical Queen of the Stardust Ballroom. And finally, she was back on Broadway at the age of 81, dancing in the revival of Follies with my old friend, a lovely man, the choreographer, Donald Sadler. They hadn't met until that show, but until well into her 90s, Marge and Donald danced twice a week just to stay in shape. Well, it worked as far as the fitness was concerned. She outlived her famous husband by 4 decades, dead at the age of 101, dancer, actress, choreographer, singer, Marge Champion.
I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, monsieur, with you. My heart won't let my feet do things they should do.
You know what? You're lovely.
And so what?
I'm lovely.
But oh, what you do to me. I'm like an ocean wave that's bumped on the shore.
I feel so absolutely stumped on the floor.
When you dance, you're charming and you're gentle.
If our lips should brush, it's accidental.
You know my approach is strictly mental.
Good heaven rest us, I'm not asbestos. And that's why I won't dance. Why should I won't dance. How could I won't dance. Merci beaucoup.
You know that music leads the way to romance. So if I hold you in my arms,
I won't dance.
And then, of course, they dance. Among the many strange social phenomena of contemporary Japan, where adult diapers outsell child diapers, where cat cafes proliferate so that lonely single persons can enjoy a nice cup of tea and some tactile contact with a feline substitute for spouse or progeny, where children's doll makers have diversified into making dolls for grown-ups to be the kids and grandkids they didn't bother having themselves, where huge percentages of young Japanese have no experience of or desire for any romantic relationship whatsoever. To these many strange contemporary phenomena, we must now add the recent spate of celebrity suicides. The wrestling star Hana Kimura killed herself at the end of May. The screen, stage and music star Haruma Miura hanged himself in July. The actress Sei Ashina was found dead earlier this month. And now Yuko Takeuchi is among their number. She won the Best Actress Award in the Japanese equivalent of the Oscars 3 years in a row. Everyone in Japan has seen Miss Takeuchi in something or other, even if it's only a commercial for Suntory beverages. The beer is called Pomp and Circumstance, which is English, obviously, Sir Edward Elgar, Last Night of the Proms. But for some reason, Miss Takeuchi enjoys its pleasures to the strains of the Brazilian song Brazil.
日本のプレミアムにエールビールという新しい風。
爽やかに香るプレミアム。The Premium Moritzkara.
Yuko Takeuchi's most recent international success was as the eponymous star of the HBO series Miss Sherlock. Yes, a distaff contemporary version of Holmes.
機械の事件。ある問題から全てのありえない事柄を排除すれば、おのずと真相が見えてくる。それがどんなに突飛な結論でもね。
気をつけて、お腹に爆弾入ってるから。裏に誰がいる。
また遺体が出た。
The trailer billed her as, quote, the most beautiful Sherlock, and she was. Found hanging in her apartment by her husband at the age of just 40, the actress Yuko Takeuchi. In the golden age of Hollywood, Rhonda Fleming was never quite an A-list star, but she had her moments. In Out of the Past, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, The Great Lover with Bob Hope, Gunfight at the OK Corral, and eventually The Nude Bomb. Her heyday was the 40s and 50s, when she was called the Queen of Technicolor, because her fair features and red hair photographed so well under that process. Personally, I'd say they photographed pretty well whatever system you were using, but we can't really demonstrate that in audio only. In Connecticut Yankee, she sang with Bing Crosby and acquitted herself respectably, so they asked her to make a few records. This is one I always liked. The song is by an art song composer, a classical composer, called Clara Edwards, born in 1880. She wrote the tune when she was 50 in 1930. And 10 years later, Jack Lawrence, whose catalogue includes Beyond the Sea and Tenderly and Sinatra's All or Nothing at All, Jack Lawrence put a rather memorable lyric to it. Rhonda Fleming sings with the wind and the rain in your hair.
Last night we met, and I dream of you yet. With the wind and the rain in your hair. As we whispered goodnight with the wind and the rain in your hair. Now it will be my favorite memory, that vision of you standing there. There in the mist, how I sighed when we kissed with the wind and the rain in your hair.
Music by Clara Edwards, words by Jack Lawrence, and a shimmering arrangement, a touch of the leaves blowing down the street you can hear in that. That was Frank Comstock and his orchestra with the wind and the rain in your hair. Dead at the age of 97, screen siren, singer, and lifelong Republican, Rhonda Fleming.
Quand on est sous l'eau, on est dans l'apesanteur la plus totale. En dessous, eh bien, un bleu de plus en plus profond. Un monde entier à découvrir.
Qu'est-ce qu'on attend?
That's from the film The Odyssey, a Franco-Belgian production about Jacques Cousteau, starring Audrey Tautou. Among those who worked on the film was the Belgian sound engineer Marc Engels, who won a César Award for Best Sound on that picture, which is pretty good, as you just heard. Here he is, picking up his prize. Well, I wanted to honour Marc Engels' achievement as a sound engineer in winning a César Award for Best Sound, but the sound engineering at that award ceremony for Best Sound is atrocious. So instead, let's have something from a film he made called I'm Dead, But I Have Friends.
Je vais vous raconter une grande histoire belge.
How are you, bunny
Jean-Pierre de Coste. Non, il n'y a pas de doute, c'est aujourd'hui et c'est terminé. La cérémonie est terminée.
Saboter les funérailles de son propre frère, ça c'est vraiment un truc de malade mental. Alors tu sais quoi? Je vais venir chez toi et je vais démonter la gueule. Espèce d'enculé!
Dead of the Chinese coronavirus at the age of 54, Marc Engels, sound engineer of I'm Dead But I Have Friends. He did. One of them, Eric Rochon, tweeted, Ce virus est une saloperie et notre douleur est infinie. The last part translates as our grief is infinite. The first part I don't think I can say on the air, but I agree with its sentiments. Let us end where we came in with Anne Reinking. 40 years ago, the director Bob Fosse made a film all about his favourite subject, himself. Fosse was played by Roy Scheider. His daughter, Nicole Fosse, was played by Ursabet Foldy. His estranged wife, the greatest of all Broadway dancing ladies, Gwen Verdon, was played by Leland Palmer. And his mistress, Anne Reinking, was played by Anne Reinking. As was Fosse's way, he dumped the mistress just before the film to add a little frisson to the drama. And then he had his missus, Gwen Verdon, teach the ex-mistress, Anne Reinking, some of the choreography. One big happy family.
And then a rehearsed tribute. Sit down,
Daddy. Sit down, Daddy. Okay. And go. Here's Ursabet Foldy and the late Anne Reinking in all that jazz just capering around the apartment. Dancing along to a record by Peter Allen.
Let me have some more Bacardi's. Let's order now what they ordered then. Cause everything old is new again. Get out your white suit and tap
scoop,
shoes and tail.
Scoop,
let's go
scoop,
back
right
when forward fails.
Strut, I know.
Movie stars, that's the fuck of long dead.
Look
now frame beside your bed. Don't throw the past away. You might need it some randy. Dreams can come true again.
What?
When everything old is new again.
I said everything old is new again.
Here we go. Stop shooting. Stop shooting tail. Let's go backwards and forward. Just leave it alone.
Go get him.
Be a movie star.
Pictures.
I'm at fall, I might fall in love, in love with you.
Don't throw the past away, we're gonna need it some rainy day. I wish I could believe in the sentiments of that number, but almost everything new is getting even more rotten, and in our hyper-present tense culture, almost everything old is entirely forgotten. But not here at Stein Online. We salute the exiting players of 2020, and we will see you in the new year.
Mark at the Movies is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.